Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 10th, and we are in Parashas Mishpatim on page 426. We're up to Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Continuing in the methods that a person damages another person, we've covered so far your animal damaging someone else's animal. We covered stealing and damaging in that manner. And now we have ki yaver ish sada ocherem. Now the word yaver, they translate it as permits livestock to devour. The word yaver does not really include that many English words. The literal translation of the word yaver is the verb to animal.
To animal.
Not to animal, but to animal. The word be'ir means a person's animals, as we're about to see. So this is the verb of that word.
Like Zayir Chametz?
No. It's related.
Maybe an Aleph.
It's related.
Oh, related to the Aleph? Okay, I don't know.
It's related to
Beer.
I want to put some
Aleph. No, that's with an iron. It's with an iron. Okay, but let's not get sidetracked with that. But the word here means the animal. So it's Kiyaver Ish Sade Ocherem. Somebody who animals, which means, as we'll see in a minute, he has his animal damage, a field or a vineyard. Now, there are two ways that your animal can damage a field or a vineyard. What are the two ways a person's animal can damage a field or a vineyard?
Maybe by grazing on it when he's not supposed to.
Eat it. Eating and trampling on it. So there are two ways for this to happen. One is Vishilachas Biro, he will send his livestock, his animals, which means that he will send them in and they will, that's to trample it, they'll step on the produce. And uvir bisteacher. And another way is that they will consume, they will animal in the other, in someone else's field. So the Torah's intention over here is to bring up the two different ways that it can happen. As is explained in the Gemara, the terminology in the Gemara is shein, teeth, that means to eat, veregel, and feet, that's to trample. Those are the two things being described over here. If one should do that, one should allow his livestock to trample or to eat in someone else's field. Meitav sadehu umeitav karmo yishalem. You have to pay the best of your field and the best of your vineyard. That's how you pay. Now there are several different rules being taught to us over here. The main point of this pasuk is that although we know that when an animal damages aggressively through biting, goring, pushing, etc., there we have a dispensation of the first three times paying only half damages, and only after the third time paying full damages. We have the category of tam, of the animal that has not been proven to be a goring animal, and muad, the animal that has been proven to be a goring animal. That's only true for aggressive acts, because since we're talking about domesticated animals, sheep, goats, cows, which don't usually act in an aggressive manner, that's why there is a dispensation for the first three times. But to trample or to eat is a normal act for an animal to do. And therefore, any owner of livestock should be aware of this and take steps to prevent their livestock from doing those things. Therefore, there is no dispensation and full price is paid for the first offense. There is no grace period. And that's why the Torah over here says he has to pay the best of his field, the best of his vineyard.
Is that land or value?
Value. So the Gemara discusses what does this mean to pay the best of his land, the best of his vineyard. And the Gemara explains that the Torah allows to pay with cash or cash equivalent. Kesef is cash. Shava kesef is cash equivalent. As long as you're paying with something that can be exchanged for cash, that's an acceptable method of payment.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to paying with real estate, with land, here the Torah does have a requirement. Here the Torah does have an opinion of what kind of land you pay with. Now, because we do not live in an agricultural society, for us, real estate is primarily based on its value. It's primarily based on location, perhaps only based on location, and the and its ability to produce crops is not something that we generally use to assess the value of real estate. But in an agricultural society, that is the most important factor, which is how will it produce crops. Location is also important, but not nearly as important as how fertile the land is. The when a person uses land to pay for some sort of a debt, the Torah does have a hierarchy of what type of land you use, because a person prefers to have the land that is more fertile over the land that is less fertile. Even though if I owe $1,000, then whichever plot of land I pay with is going to be worth $1,000. The more fertile land will be a smaller piece of land that's worth $1,000. The less fertile land will be a larger piece of land that's worth $1,000. Either way, it's going to be worth $1,000. It's just that a person would prefer a smaller piece of land that is more fertile over a larger piece of land that is less fertile. A smaller piece of land that is more fertile requires less work to produce that its produce, to make it produce crops. And so a person would always prefer the smaller, more fertile land. So here, when one owes a debt because of damages, because his animal damaged someone else's land, there the Torah requires that you pay the best. Meitav sadehu or meitav karmo yishalem, you pay the best of the fields and vineyards that you have. You pay the, as the Gemara calls it, the idis, the best of the lands, which is what a person would prefer to receive. Now again, we're not judging here the value, because the value is the same no matter what you pay. You, if you owe $1,000, you got to pay $1,000. Doesn't matter whether you're paying with the best of your lands or the worst of your lands, you got to pay $1,000. The issue is not how much money you're paying. The issue is what type of land you're paying with. So for damages, we require the best of the land. This is in contrast to, for example, paying for a loan. Repaying a loan, there the Torah does not require that you pay with the best of your lands. Or, for example, the land that is designated to pay for a ksuba, for a marriage document. There the Torah does not require that it be the best of the lands. Again, the value is going to be the same, whatever the value is. The ksuba value is whatever it's fixed to be, and the land has to be commensurate with the fixed value. But does it have to be the best of the lands? No, it doesn't have to be the best of the lands for a ksuba. It does not have to be the best of the lands for repaying a loan. But for damages, you have to pay with the best of your lands. Any questions?
It says here, if someone will send his animal into a field, what if the person doesn't send them deliberately, but it's through a passive act of negligence?
Right, so negligence is considered sending. That's the point the Torah is making over
so
here.
So everything is considered sending. Any way that your animals get into somebody else's land.
If you fenced in your animals appropriately and there was an onus, there was some sort of act of God, lightning struck the fence, and as a result the animals got out, it could be there would be an exemption.
Yeah.
Because you did take the proper steps. But if you didn't take the proper steps, that is tantamount to sending the animal into someone else's field. You have to be aware that that's what animals do. And Torah expects the livestock owner to be responsible. Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Another form of damages is Kisei Tse'esh, when fire will go out. Umatza Kotzim, and it finds thorns, Vinachal Gadish, and then it consumes a pile of grain, or akamot, or standing grain, or asadet, or the field itself, which means that it destroys the field's ability to produce crops. Shalem yishalem hamavir habeira, the one who lights the fire must pay. Here, the Torah is expecting the one who lights a fire to make sure that the fire is contained. And this is something which we're all aware of,
yeah,
that the person who lights a fire is responsible for a fire. And the Torah here squarely puts that responsibility on the shoulders of the one who lights the fire. Even if a person lights the fire in his own domain, even if a person lights a fire in an area where he has every right to burn everything in sight, but he also has the responsibility to contain the fire to make sure it does not go beyond the boundaries of the place which he has the right to burn. And if it does go beyond the boundaries, he is responsible. This is true. The Gemara discusses what happens if a wind comes and fans the fire, blows the fire. Anybody who lights a fire is responsible for that fire wherever it goes because they lit the fire. So this is pretty straightforward. We are used to this because we live in a society that has a similar law. It's not necessarily the case that secular society throughout the ages has had a law like this. We have always had a law like this. In the United States of America, this is the prevalent law, but it has not always been so. There have been societies where a person can claim, I was lighting a fire in my own domain, I was burning my thing. What happens afterwards is not my problem. It's your responsibility to make sure that your fields, lands, etc. are protected from potential fires. It's not my problem. One could theoretically argue such a thing, but the Torah rejects that argument. The one who lights the fire is responsible for the fire no matter where it goes. So as we mentioned last time, the Torah recognizes four categories of damagers that are laid at the feet of the person. One category is your animal doing damages. Another category is a pit, which is what we mentioned before, which we talked about, a pit dug in the public domain. Another category is fire, and the fourth category is the person himself. And we mentioned that these four avos nizikin, these four fathers of damaging, they are categories. So we mentioned last time that a pit in the public domain is an unmoving damage, a potential damager. It remains where it is, and the victim stumbles into it. That's one form of damaging. And we mentioned that it's not only a pit, but if one puts any kind of thing that doesn't move in a place where it can cause damage, that would be go into the category of the pit. With livestock, so there you have this. That's specifically animals. And the reason why that's specifically animals is, as we mentioned, animals have a tendency to do one thing and not another thing. They have a tendency to trample. They have a tendency to eat. They don't have a tendency to be aggressive. And so, therefore, the laws are different depending on what type of damaging is being done by the livestock. A fire is a type of, we'll call it an inanimate object. It's not a live object, but it moves. But it moves, and it moves on its own. It has its own mobility. I guess it's not actually moving, it's growing, but it gets from one place to another in that manner. And that would include any type of damage that would be similar to a fire, that it can move along. So, for example, if a person has a lot of water in their domain, a person has a huge tank of water in their domain, well, water, like fire, can move, and it can cause damage as it moves. So if a person has a large tank of water, has, 1,000 gallons of water, an above-ground pool or something like that, and a person does not take steps to make sure that the water does not leave his domain, the water then does exit his domain, and it's a negligence, that will fall under the general category of the fire, of that type of damage. And then, of course, there is the person. And the person is a whole different set up, because a person is considered to be the most responsible, whereas the fire, the pit, and the livestock are things that I own or created, but so I'm responsible for them, but I am most responsible for me. And whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to be most responsible for. So the Gemara goes through with these four categories and sets the parameters for them so that we can understand what gets put into which category, to understand how much a person has to pay, how much a person is obligated to be careful, where the responsibility begins, where the responsibility ends. Any questions? Okay. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Now we move on to the whole discussion of pikadon. Pikadon means an object, I'm not sure a good, succinct way to say this in English, an object that is given to somebody else. When I have an object and I give it to somebody else, either to watch it or to use it.
Like a custodian.
Right, right, like a custodian. So we're not here talking about lending money, we're talking about an object. I lend you my car, I give you my lawnmower, I have I have an expensive piece of jewelry that I give you for safekeeping. Mm-hmm. All of that is going to be covered in the next several paragraphs. We know from the Gemara, and we'll see it here in the Chumash as we go through, that the Torah recognizes four types. I guess custodians are the right word. Is that the word they use over here?
Yeah, they use custodians.
Okay, that's a good word. So the Torah recognizes four types of custodians. There is the Shomer Chinam. The Shomer Chinam means the one who agrees to watch something that belongs to somebody else, and they're unpaid. So that means that I have an expensive piece of jewelry, expensive piece of electronics. I'm leaving town for a week. I don't want to leave it in my house where no one is going to be. So I knock on your door and I say to you, listen, I'm going out of town for a week. Would you please keep this expensive item in your home for the week while I'm gone? I feel safer if it's with you than if it's in an empty house, in my empty house. And you agree. So now it's in your home. And then something happens to the object. It's stolen. It's damaged. Something happens to it. So what is your level of responsibility? That is called a shomer chinam. You agreed to watch it and you're not being paid. So there, your level of responsibility is going to be the least, because you're not getting anything out of it and you're doing me a favor. You're watching it for me for free. So your level of responsibility is going to be the least. You still do have some responsibility, but it's going to be the least responsible. Then the Torah recognizes the next level up would be Shomer Sachar. The same thing, but it's a paid custodian. So I knock on your door, I say, I'm going out of town for a week. I'd like you to keep my expensive electronics in your home. I recognize that it means that you're going to have to be more careful with watching my item, and therefore I'm going to pay you. I will offer to pay you so that you will take responsibility for my object. And you agree. And so we strike a deal. So I'm paying you in return for your watching my object. So there, you're doing me a favor, it's true, but you're also being paid. So there is what you're giving to me and what you're gaining. So you're kind of in the middle, and there the level of responsibility will be greater than the unpaid custodian. Then we move to, I'm going to skip one, for which I'll explain why in a moment, we move to the greatest level of responsibility, and that is the borrower. A borrower is the most responsible. You come to me and you say, listen, can I borrow your car? And I say, sure. Now, there, I'm doing you the favor. You are getting something and you're not giving anything for it. So there, you are getting the favor, I'm doing the favor, and you become the custodian because you now have my car. That's going to require the greatest level of responsibility. As we'll see, the Torah will explain that there, your liability is the highest because you're getting everything and giving nothing. So your level of responsibility is the highest. The category I skipped, which is the third category, is a very common one, but I skipped it for a reason, and that is the renter. A renter is, you're using my car, but you're paying me for the use of my car. So here, a renter also has two sides to the story. On the one hand, you're getting something out of it, because you get use of the car. On the other hand, you're paying me for it, so it's not for free. So I'm also getting something out of it. What is your level of responsibility? And here, as we'll see when we read it in the Chumash, the Torah is the most vague about a renter. And it leads to a dispute in the Gemara whether a renter's responsibility will be the same as the Shomer Sachar, as the paid custodian, which is the middle ground, which perhaps that's what we would have said intuitively. And the other opinion is that no, the renter's responsibility is that of the lowest responsibility, that of the unpaid custodian of the Shomer Chinam. That the renter is one of the least responsible ones. So we'll discuss that again. I will review all of this as we move along, but I wanted to give you this introduction to show you where we're going over here as we now move into the four types of custodians. And again, these four are meant to be categories. And every time that you have in your possession something that belongs to somebody else, you will fall into one of these four categories. You will either fall into the category of the unpaid custodian, or the paid custodian, or the borrower, or the renter. And the Torah uses these general groups so that we can fit everybody into one of these four so we can determine the level of liability. And that will, of course, determine how much you're going to have to pay or whether you have to pay under certain circumstances. Interestingly, unlike the categories of damagers, here it is negotiable. Because you and I can strike whatever deal we want. I can say to you that I'd like to borrow your car, but I don't want to be responsible like a real borrower. I don't want to have that level of liability. Now, you don't have to agree, so don't give me your car. But if you agree to the terms, we can agree to reduce my level of liability or increase my level of liability, depending on our agreement, because people can make whatever contracts they want, and it's an agreement. This, what the Torah is going to describe, is the default. The default is these four levels of responsibility, depending whether it's an unpaid custodian, paid custodian, renter, or borrower. And that's what we're going to present right now. So if you still have questions, let's see as we move along, you'll see how it comes up. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. If a man will give to his friend, kasef, money, now this does not mean a loan. A loan is totally different because when I lend you money, you're not expected to hold on to the coins or to the cash. You're expected to spend it and then pay me back with other coins or cash. So there is no custodian there. You're not a custodian for my money. You're spending my money. That's what I gave it to you to do. I gave it to you to get rid of it. You're now, not that I should lose it, but I gave it to you with the right to now get rid of it. You have no right to take my car and joyride with it and destroy it and then buy me another one. You don't have a right to do that. If I lend you my car, rent you my car, then you are responsible for giving back the same car. Now, if you damage it, well, you have to make amends. But you're not allowed to deliberately destroy it and give me another car. That wasn't the term of the agreement. But with money, the whole point of lending money is it's for you to spend, to quote-unquote destroy it, to consume it, and then give me back other money. So you're not a custodian when you borrow money. You are a borrower who has to repay money. You now have a debt, but you're not a custodian. Here when it says money, it means coins that are collectibles, that are meant to be watched and then returned. So if a man will give to his friend, kasef, money, okelim, or utensils, lishmor, to watch, to guard. That's the key phrase. It's not to spend, it's to guard. Vigunav mibeis ha'ish. And then the item or items are stolen from the house of the man. So is the unpaid custodian, which is what we're talking about over here. I gave it to you to watch, but I didn't pay you to do it. So you're an unpaid custodian. Are you responsible for theft? So first the Torah says the obvious point, imi matzei aganov, if we find the thief, yishalem shnayim, the thief will have to pay double. This we learned before, that someone who steals, then he is discovered, he has to pay double for his theft. Bear in mind that if I give you an item to watch, I knock on your door, and I say to you, I'm going out of town for a week. I don't want to take my laptop with me, but I don't want to leave it in the house. Would you please keep it in your house? And you say, sure, put it in the house. Unfortunately, there is a burglary, and my laptop is stolen from your house. So that's what the Torah is addressing over here. But how do I know the laptop was stolen from your house? Perhaps you took the laptop from your house or hid the laptop and claimed it was stolen. How do I know? All I have is your word that it was stolen. So the Torah here, when it says it was stolen from the house of the man, what the Torah means to say is there's a claim that it was stolen. So if there's a claim that it was stolen, so if we find the thief, well, that proves the claim was correct. Obviously, if the thief is discovered, we now know with certainty that what you told me happened really did happen. It was stolen. In which case, the thief pays double. That's obvious. But what if the thief is never found? If the thief is not discovered, then what do? It's your word claiming that there was a theft. Then the Baal Habayis, the owner of the homeowner, which you're the person, that's the person guarding the object, will come close to the Elohim. We've mentioned before that the word Elohim means power. That's what it means. Usually it means God. In some cases, and in this case specifically, it doesn't mean God, it means court. It means court, because the court has power, has jurisdiction. So here, the word Elohim is used to mean the court. So the owner of the home, the homeowner, will now come close to the court. And Imlo Shalach Yado Bimlechet Re'ehu, if he did not send his hand against the, literally the work of his friend, but it means the object of his friend. So he will come to court and he will state in court, I did not send my hand against the object, which is the same thing as saying, I didn't take the laptop. Yes, the laptop was in my home, but it was taken by somebody else. I did not lay a hand on the laptop. Now, it doesn't mean I didn't touch the laptop, because part of watching it might have been to pick it up and place it in a more secure place in the house. That's not called shlichus yad. That's not called laying your hand on the laptop. But it means I didn't. You are telling the court I did not make use of the laptop. I did what I was supposed to do, which is I guarded it. That's all I did. I never put my hand against it. I never took it. I never used it. I never put it someplace so that you wouldn't be able to find it. That's what you're saying. Here the Torah doesn't say it explicitly, but we will learn later on that this is an oath. You take an oath in court that you did not lay a hand on the laptop, that you didn't do anything to it. The Torah says, Al kol dvar pesha, on all, how do they translate this? On all
items of liability.
Okay, items of liability. Al shor, this could be true about an ox. Al kamor, or a donkey. Al seh, or a sheep. Al salma, or an article of clothing. For some reason, Torah doesn't mention laptops. Al kol aveidah, on all lost objects. Ashe yomar, then he will say ki hu zeh. This is the item that he'll say, this is the item that was stolen, this is the item that was lost. Ad ho Elohim yavod var shnehem, to the court, the word of both of them will come. Asher yarshiun Elohim, whoever the court finds to be the Rasha, that finds to be the evil one, Yishalim shnaim l're'eh, will pay double to his friend. So what does that verse mean? So let's paint this picture. You have claimed that the object was stolen. The Torah says, what do? We go to court and you swear in court that the object was stolen. That oath exempts you from payment. Since you are an unpaid custodian, you are not liable if it was stolen from your property. That level of liability is too high for an unpaid custodian. After all, no one wants a thief walking through their home. No one wants a burglar in their home. And therefore, typically, you're going to keep burglars out of your home. If someone breaks in and steals my laptop, that's my problem. You're an unpaid custodian. Unpaid custodians are not liable for theft. But how do we know it was stolen? It's only because you say so. So you have to take an oath in court stating that it was stolen. Or you may not know for a fact it was stolen. You have to take an oath in court that you did not lay a hand on the object. And as we'll see later on, the actual oath that you take is, I wasn't negligent. Because an unpaid custodian is responsible for negligence. That you're responsible for. So that if my laptop, you place my laptop on the floor and then you step on it, well, that's negligence. And you are liable for that even though you're an unpaid custodian. If you put my laptop on your kitchen table and your four-year-old spills apple juice all over it, well, then you're liable because that's negligence. Negligence, even an unpaid custodian, is liable for. But theft, you're not liable for. So you have to take an oath in court that you worked two things. That you did not actually physically take it yourself, and you were not negligent. You can't take an oath that it was stolen, because unless you saw the thief walk into your house and to walk off with the laptop, how do you know it was stolen? You know that it used to be on the shelf, and now it's not there. What happened to it? You don't know for a fact that it was stolen. Maybe it disappeared into another dimension. I don't know, but you don't know what happened to it. So to take an oath that it was stolen is unfair. How can we make you take such an oath? But we can make you take an oath that you didn't steal it and that you weren't negligent. That you can take an oath for. Those oaths will exempt you from payment. But what happens now? What happens now? This is the next verse. And as soon as we finish this paragraph, then we'll take questions. But what happens now if then, as the Torah says, Asher yomar ki hu zeh, that he will say this is the object, which means now there is a dispute about this object. My laptop was in your possession. You came and took an oath that it's gone. You did not take it yourself, and you weren't negligent. But then witnesses come, and the witnesses say, you know, we saw you walking off with that laptop. Well, if witnesses come and say that you walked off with the laptop, then you are liable because you took it yourself. Mm-hmm. What happens if witnesses come and say that we saw you walking off with the laptop on the evening of July 13th in Atlanta, Georgia? And then two other witnesses come and say, you first two witnesses, you're liars. Because you weren't in Atlanta on July 13th. You were with us in Los Angeles on July 13th. You couldn't have possibly seen him walking off with the laptop on July 13th in Atlanta because you were with us in Los Angeles. That proves that the witnesses are in fact the liars, mm-hmm. not the person who was watching the laptop. So that's why it could be a court case. Just because witnesses come and say that they saw you walking off with the laptop, that doesn't necessarily end the court case. Because what if those witnesses are incriminated? So that's what the Torah means over here, that if there is a claim that someone claims ki hu zeh, this is the object, meaning we saw that person with the object, then the claim comes to court, and the court will find who the evil one is, and whoever is the evil one will pay double. Now, I want to make 2 points over here, and then we'll stop for questions. I realize there's a lot of information here. A thief pays double. That's the law. A thief pays double. We mentioned, I don't know if it was last time, before, it was last time, that it's a thief. Again, I don't know the English terminology. Which one is the one who steals in front of someone else, you know, who openly, you know, the one who, the, what's that?
You're talking about the
Ganav and Gazlan. The purse snatcher does it in front of your face, right? The I'm talking about someone who breaks into the house in the middle of the night, they're doing it on the fly. Here we're talking about someone who does it on the fly. The ganav is the one who does it on the fly. A ganav pays double. A gazlan, someone who steals openly, they're a scoundrel, but they don't pay double. They only pay back the object they stole. We discussed that last time. A thief pays double. Now, what happens, I'm telling you a new case because I want to bring out a point. What happens if you lend me money? You lend me $1,000. Okay? And then, come time to pay the money, and you come to me and say, you owe me, where's pay up? And I say, pay for what? And you say, the $1,000 that I lent you. And I say,
what are you talking about?
What $1,000?
You didn't lend me anything.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So, it's your word against mine.
Right.
You can't get me to pay based on your word against mine. Then two witnesses come to court and say, Pransky's a liar. He did borrow the $1,000. We saw it. Okay, I was caught. Now I have to pay. Do I pay double?
You should.
I should, right? Because I'm a liar. Right?
I'm triple. Paying for lying.
The law is that you don't pay double in that case.
Because
I'm not a thief.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a thief. The definition of a thief is, listen very carefully, the Torah's definition of theft is that I take something from your possession unlawfully into my possession. When you lend me money, I did not take anything from your possession unlawfully into my possession. It was lawful. You willingly handed me $1,000. Now, it's true, I'm a scoundrel, I'm a liar when I denied it, but I did not do an act of theft to take unlawfully from your possession to my possession. When there's no theft, then you don't pay double. Now, over here, what happened? I came to your house and I deposited my laptop in your house. Then, I come back a week later and you claim it's gone. I don't know what happened to it. And you take the oath in court. Then, witnesses come and say, we saw you take the laptop. Okay, you were caught. You now owe me a laptop. Do you owe me double?
No.
So the Torah here says you do owe double.
You
wait a minute, You did not take that laptop from my possession to your possession, from my domain to your domain. You didn't do that. Following what we just said before, you should not have to pay double in this case. Because you didn't. It's the same thing. It's like me denying the loan. You denied the fact that the laptop. Well, you didn't deny that you had it, but you make a claim saying that you don't have to pay it back. So, really, if we follow the parameters of the Torah, there shouldn't have to be a payment of double in this case because you didn't unlawfully take the laptop from my possession to yours. It was always in. I put it down in your possession. I put it in your house. So it was lawful. So here the Torah is saying a novel concept. When you claim theft, listen carefully. When you claim theft and you're lying, you're treated like a thief. You're given the law of the thief. And therefore you pay double. Claiming theft is akin to theft.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than saying, what loan? I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't claim theft. I denied the loan. That's not claiming theft. Claiming theft is the same thing as theft itself. And the Torah puts upon that person the same penalty it does for theft itself. That is a novel idea which we find over here. That the one who claims theft is like the thief and pays double. That's one point I wanted to make to you before we take questions. The second point I want to make to you, which is difficult for us Americans who are used to the American judicial system to grasp, to wrap our minds around, but the idea of taking an oath in court is not common, which means over here we're saying that the person takes an oath in court to say, I wasn't negligent and I didn't take it myself. Fine. A typical witness. Witnesses come to court. They say, we saw, whatever, we saw Reuven damage Shimon's car. We saw, whatever, they make whatever claim they say. Any witnesses. Is there an oath? There is no oath. Witnesses do not testify under oath in a Jewish court. There is no testimony that is under oath in a Jewish court of witnesses. See, we're used to the idea that witnesses testify under oath, because that's what happens in the American court system. That's not true in the Torah court system. Witnesses are cross-examined. You need two witnesses. They're cross-examined, of course, separately, and their stories have to corroborate. But assuming that their stories do corroborate, we accept their testimony without oath. Later on, if they are proven to be liars, under certain circumstances, there will be penalties and punishments on those witnesses for lying in court. But it is not under oath. It is simply speaking in court without an oath is already a serious proposition. When you walk into court as a witness to testify without taking an oath, your word is taken very seriously, and if we act upon your word and then later it turns out you are lying, you can be liable for all kinds of damages and punishments, including lashes and various types of punitive damages that could happen depending on the circumstances. We don't require an oath in order to hold someone to their word. That's not necessary. In a Jewish court of law, your word is considered to be serious, whether it's under oath or not. This is not a witness. This is the litigant himself. The litigant himself, I'm saying to you, where's my laptop? And you're saying, I don't know what happened to it. It was here and it's gone. So you and I are now the litigants. So this is a case where you take an oath. It's not the witness taking an oath, it's the litigant taking an oath. I'm just trying to get that out there because it's very hard for us to think in those terms because we're not used to it. But that's the way it works in a Jewish court of law. That in here, the litigant takes an oath in order to become exempt. I have to tell you that if we go to court because I claim that I lent you $1,000 and you say it's not true, no oath is required. It's my word against yours. So what do we say? Possession is 9/10 of the law. So you have possession. I'm trying to extract money from you. The burden of proof is on me. If I can't prove that you owe me $1,000, then you walk away scot-free because I can't prove it. Maybe I'm making up a story. So there's no requirement for just because there's a claim against you, there's no requirement to take an oath. Here, the reason why there's a requirement to take an oath is because we have established that you did have the laptop in your possession. That's not being disputed. It was there. Mm-hmm. Now it's gone. So that's why there's a burden of proof on you to take an oath. But you're right, there is a difference between here and the witnesses. The witnesses, there's corroboration. Here, there is no corroboration. It's just your word.
If I say you stole money from me, and that's what I really think.
Right, no, right. You're right. You're right. If I claim someone else stole from me, then you're right. That would not be like theft itself. But I'm talking about over here where you gave me something to watch, mm-hmm. and then I say, I don't know what happened to it. It must have been stolen. So I'm claiming theft to exempt myself.
Oh, I see.
I'm not claiming theft in order to get you to pay me something. I'm claiming theft because, don't look at me, someone else stole it. So I'm trying to remove the claim against me by saying, it was stolen. So if I'm telling the truth, it's fine. But if I'm lying, I'm treated like a thief.
Suppose you give something to someone to keep for you, and then when you go to get it back, you say, hey, that's not the one I gave you.
Okay.
I mean, it looks exactly alike, but it doesn't work as good.
Okay.
If it's an animal, it doesn't mark as well.
So in that case, you would bring witnesses that it's not the same item, and people who had seen it in your home, you know, or you would have some sort of a sign to prove that it wasn't yours, and then the court would turn, assuming that you could establish that, you have to be able to establish that. Once you establish that, the court would turn to me and say, what's going on? So then, depending on what my response is, that's how the court case would proceed. If I would claim that you're lying, it really is your object, well then it's all going to hinge on the proof that you're bringing as to whether it is or isn't. If I admit that, no, you're right, it's not the same object, well then what happened? So it's going to depend what I say after that. Right? Very often, if I was negligent and my kid did spill apple juice all over his laptop, and I'm embarrassed, so I'm going to want to make up for it. I'm going to want to run out to the store and buy a laptop to give back to you so that, you know, we can still be friends, right? So there, if I admit to it, so I didn't take an oath and lie. I tried to get away with something, but I didn't lie in court, and I did admit to it as soon as you claimed. So then I'm not going to be a thief. I'm going to admit to it. I was negligent, and here's what I'm doing to replace it. So then the court will have to decide whether what I'm giving you is an acceptable replacement or not. And so if you're claiming it runs more slowly, that'll be the court's assessment. There are times where the Gemara will say, Pater bidei adam, which means that the person is exempt in the court, but chayav bidei shamayim. But from heaven, they're obligated to make up for it.
Right.
There are situations like that in the Torah. This is not one of them.
Okay.
This is not one of them. But there are situations that where we do say that, where the court can't force you to pay because it wasn't that bad, but you really weren't acting properly, and therefore, from upstairs, they're expecting you to do something to make up for it.
And if you don't, then Shaman can get you.
It's a little bit unclear exactly what "if you don't" is, but you don't want upstairs to be, you don't want that. So, but in this case, you're 100% exempt. You don't have to do anything. Now, because we're friends, we're always going to want to try to make amends. You know, that's typical human behavior. The Torah has to deal with the nitty gritty of daily life. Okay, this is how we live our lives, and so the Torah has to deal with this stuff. And people get into all kinds of situations, and people make all kinds of claims, and there's all kinds of cover up, and there's not anything that happens. People do it. So the Torah here is dealing with on that level. It is true that ultimately, keeping the real goal in mind. The real goal of all of our lives is that we purify ourselves and we act properly so that when we are ready to move to the next world, we can return our souls to our Maker in a pristine state rather than a soiled state. That is no question the ultimate goal of all of us. But the Torah has to deal on the level of the human being. And that can involve all kinds of behavior that is not appropriate. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a thief has to pay double and cannot do it, is the only option in the Torah for the thief to sell himself into slavery?
So the what it says is that if a thief can't pay, he gets sold into slavery. The court sells him into slavery. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. The question is, what happens if he's off by $10? Mm-hmm. Are we going to sell him into slavery for $10? So I don't remember this being dealt with directly, but I imagine that if we're talking about a few dollars, the court is not going to rush to sell him into slavery. The court will try to find another recourse.
Right.
You know, garnish his wages or something in order to in order to avoid selling him into slavery. But there are times when the debt is so high that there's no... Now remember, I just want to emphasize, just because you brought it up, that being sold into slavery is only for theft. If I borrow money and don't pay back, there's no sale into slavery. That doesn't. It's only for theft. It's only a person actually stole something and doesn't pay back. That's when they get sold into slavery.
Are fraud and theft the same?
It's not clear exactly because our fraud today is often, maybe always, electronic, and how that works from the Torah's perspective is very difficult because nothing's actually moving. Nothing's actually changing. It's just numbers.
Right.
There's nothing actually happening. So
something happened in your bank
there. Yeah, but there's no physical movement of objects. Right. The Torah's whole discussion is based on moving something from one domain to another domain. And it's
from one account to another account.
Right, it's true, but it's just numbers. It's not nothing physical has actually been picked up and moved. It's just that there's a registry somewhere that has a different
understanding.
Right.
Right.
So I'm not sure how the Torah would deal with that. And it's a little bit murky.
The thief that, you know, in court they found that he was guilty and he can't pay it. What do we do these days? We don't have
that kind of jurisdiction.
Huh?
We don't have that kind of jurisdiction. A Jewish court today doesn't have the ability to punish or to. We can't, you know.
It depends on the land law of the land.
A Jewish court today works usually through arbitration, which means that the two sign an arbitration agreement that they're going to let the Jewish court decide what the rule is going to be. That's usually how it works. But ultimately, who's going to enforce it? The enforcing of it is going to be the secular court. And if the Jewish court rules in favor of the plaintiff, and then the defendant doesn't want to pay, well, the Jewish court can't do anything about it. The plaintiff will then take the defendant to the secular court and say, we signed an arbitration agreement, the Jewish court ruled in my favor, I want him to pay. Well, when we have, it doesn't have to be some English, but we have to have our own authority. We have the ability to govern ourselves, you know, before we can actually enact any of this.
When do we actually say that?
The next time it will happen will be when the Beis HaMikdash. Look, in theory, if the state of Israel would adopt a judicial system according to the Torah, then
right.
We'd have it.
That's right.
But they don't.
That's right.
Do they have the authority to do it?
The state of Israel has its own authority. They can set up whatever rules they want in the state. So they could, theoretically. Okay.
Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.